This
is
the
takeaway
for
Thursday,
May
19th,
2016.
Thanks so much for listening on this special Echoes of the 1980s program. Hit the B square. We're right here. This isn't some kind of holiday show. Later in the program, we'll have a look at what part nostalgia and what part up-to-the-minute news is contained in the Broadway musical American Psycho, in which, yes, you can hear this tune from Huey Lewis and the News. But back in 1985, during the last years of the Cold War, NATO was beloved in the West and feared by the Soviet Union. Today, it is neither. And it is neither feared nor beloved by Vladimir Putin in Moscow. We begin this hour 25 years out from the fall of the Soviet Union. The U.S. is consumed with domestic concerns and worried about terrorism overseas or on the ground. Europe is also preoccupied with the migrant crisis and its stagnant economy. The countries on the border with Russia, well, they're afraid.
Belarus, it's a communism with a taste of cappuccino. On the same street in downtown of Minsk, you can see McDonald's, and in front of McDonald's, a monument of Lenin. All the maneuvers of Russian army are happening in Belarus, especially this brigade, which occupied Crimea. It was training always in Belarus. So let's say Belarus is independent, but if NATO and the West will not be doing anything, it will be just a new dungeon for Putin expansion to Europe.
That's Frank Viacorka, a Belarusian youth activist and journalist who visited us at the Takeaway this spring. Across the Black Sea, there's talk of this creeping of Russian activity, a new radar station in occupied Crimea, shadow troops in Belarus, Russian spy ships in the Black Sea. If push came to shove, Frank says,
if you ask 16 years old boy in Minsk, who are you? He will definitely tell, I'm Belarusian. And if you will ask him with whom you want to be, he'll definitely choose European Union, the Western society. But of course, there is a big conflict with the older post-Soviet generation who still supporting Moscow policy. And if they will have choice, they will be voting for Putin.
Sir Richard Sheriff, former deputy commando of NATO between 2011 and 2014, wants all the members of Europe and NATO, including the United States, to adopt a tone of warning to Russia. Otherwise, a preoccupied and disengaged NATO, he believes, is on a crash course with Russia. And that means war. Sir Richard joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
What is the mission of NATO, in your view, right now?
NATO's task under Article 5 of the Washington Treaty is to defend the member states of NATO. Collective defense, an attack on one is an attack on all. And in a sense, the purpose of the book is to highlight the importance of that.
And Latvia is a crucial part of NATO today in the same way that NATO understood its member states 25 years ago?
Absolutely. The three Baltic states of Latvia, Estonia, Lithuania, small, proud, very brave states, fought against, achieved their independence and liberty from the Soviet Union 25 years ago. They are honorable and committed members of the alliance, and they deserve absolutely the collective defense that the alliance guarantees to them.
I'm puzzled, though. Europe can barely conceal its contempt for Greece and Turkey at this point. Why do we believe it's going to defend Latvia?
Well, because they're NATO allies. It's as simple as that. The commitment of the NATO alliance is total. They are members of the alliance, and as I say, it's within the terms, the founding principle of the alliance is collective defence, and that means extending that defence to all NATO allies under threat. And I would also add that Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania have shown a remarkable commitment to the alliance since they joined. Their soldiers fought and died alongside American soldiers, alongside British soldiers in Afghanistan, and they absolutely deserve our support.
Donald Trump says NATO is irrelevant in our time, outmoded. What's your response?
I would say that that is pretty well wide of the mark. NATO is an alliance that has served the West well. It's built on principles of liberty, democracy, the rule of law. It defended the West during the years of the Cold War under American leadership. It remains as relevant today as it has done in the past. Of course it needs to adapt. Of course it needs to change. But I'm confident that we'll see at the Warsaw Summit coming up the sort of announcements we need that highlight the importance of deterrence and ensuring that peace remains in Europe.
What are those announcements that you believe will restore deterrence? Because certainly deterrence is not what we would call Vladimir Putin in occupying Crimea, in his dealings with Georgia, etc.
What needs to happen is that the bar needs to be raised so high, or at least sufficiently high, that any potential adversary recognizes it is simply not worth the risk of one Russian soldier stepping a foot across the boundaries of NATO.
So it sounds to me that you're saying to prevent the war scenario that would come from Putin thinking that there is an opening here requires the U.S. to and NATO to put essentially comparable conventional forces on the borders of the Baltic states, Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, plus not rule out a use of nuclear weapons on Russian territory should Vladimir Putin move. What makes you think that Cameron and whoever the U.S. president is are going to go there?
Well, firstly, on the nuclear issue, we know that NATO remains a nuclear alliance. The nuclear capabilities, principally of the United States, but also Britain and France as well, remain the ultimate guarantor of peace.
Putin doesn't believe that.
Well, I think there is enough uncertainty. The fact is that as we're talking now, the nuclear deterrence is at sea, somewhere underwater around the world, and there's enough uncertainty in the mind of any potential adversary to deter.
What's the evidence of that uncertainty? What's the evidence that, I mean, I look at Putin's face, I don't see any uncertainty on
well,
question
I think
of
that's
nuclear.
I think there's enough, and I think that's why you need conventional capability as well. And if I can just turn to that, what is needed is not necessarily to match the Russian capability. I don't believe we're in the business of returning to, for example, to the Cold War levels of commitment from the United States and other allies that we saw in West Germany, for example, during the Cold War. But we need enough, and that means enough that is, in simple terms, that is capable, that is joined up, that would present enough of a war-fighting challenge to Putin to make him realize that it's simply not worth his while putting a foot across the Russian border.
And Putin is going to be humbled by such a statement at the moment that Britain is contemplating Brexit and a backing away from its European commitments?
Well, the answer to that is no. These are member states of NATO. NATO is duty-bound to defend them. This is no more, no less than you or I putting a lock on our house or a security light up to guard our property. Added to which, I would add that I think the Russians respect strength and they despise weakness. So this is NATO showing that it's prepared to step up to the mark. On the issue of Britain's commitment, my personal view is that Britain leaving the European Union would result in a weaker European Union. It would be like taking a brick out of the wall. So I'm hoping, of course, that Britain remains in the European Union, because the security challenges Europe faces are so multidimensional, so complex, that it's not as simple as saying just military power is required.
We're talking with Sir Richard Sheriff, who was the deputy commander of NATO between 2011 and 2014. We're talking about his book, 2017 War with Russia. I know you don't speak for NATO, but in your experience with NATO, doesn't the organization have a bit of a credibility problem in its dealings with the United States regarding Iraq and particularly Afghanistan, which I think it's fair to say was not a successful military mission, even though one can argue that it might have been worse had NATO not gone in there. But again, the question of whether Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan or not is the strategic question, and I think that's sort of a wash at this point. When Putin looks at NATO, he sees a puppet of the United States.
Yeah, I think the NATO mission in Afghanistan, and I would beg to differ on this, I think actually what we saw was the alliance coming together, 28 nations plus 22 partner nations from as far afield as Australia, New Zealand, Finland, Sweden, even Mongolia, coming together to implement a strategy which by the end of 2014 had achieved its aim of being able to pass on security to the Afghan security forces. Now, of course, the future of Afghanistan continues to depend on the commitment of the international community. So I think the credibility of NATO there was pretty good. Where I think you have a very important point is the issue of the willingness of European nations to step up to the mark in terms of funding defence. And I think there it is critical that European members of NATO really understand the importance of putting their weight, putting their money where their mouth is in essential terms, and not depending on the United States to foot the bill.
So you would support Donald Trump's suggestion that NATO nations pay more for their defense?
I would say that the promise made by NATO, the rather lame promise made by NATO nations at the end of the last NATO summit in Wales in 2014, that they would try to raise defence spending to 2% of GDP within 10 years, is simply not good enough.
You know, Sir Richard Sheriff, I have to say, as I listen to you and listen to the tone in your voice, it really takes me back to the 1980s. I mean, this idea of almost, you know, like Montgomery. This feeling of mission and preparedness and projection of strength that comes from your voice. You hear the European rhetoric now. You hear what's coming out of the United States. How are you going to infect the leaders of Europe with some of your esprit de corps, sir?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is all about, I think you put your foot on it, a finger on it. This is about leadership, and it's about stepping up to the mark. And in a sense, the story of the book is the story of how this sense of defeatism can be turned around by the leadership of an individual. I'm not going to give the story away, but on this occasion, it's not so much cometh the hour, cometh the man, but cometh the hour, cometh the woman, in the form of the President of the United States.
Sir Richard Sheriff, Deputy Commander of NATO between 2011 and 2014. His new book is 2017, War with Russia. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive. They live their lives. Learn more at lls.org.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. After more than 2 years, one of the nearly 300 Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram has been found. In 2014, the Islamic militant group abducted the girls from their boarding school in Chibok, Nigeria. The action prompted worldwide outrage and a campaign to bring back our girls. About 50 managed to escape shortly after the abduction. But this young woman found this week is the first to be found since then. She reportedly said that some of the girls have died, but many remain in captivity. More than 200 of the girls are still missing. Dion Searcy is the West Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She joins me now from Dakar, Senegal. Hello, Dion.
Hello.
How much information has been obtained from this young girl, and where was she found?
Well, the details are slowly coming out. She was found apparently wandering the Sambisa Forest, which is a known Boko Haram hideout. What we know so far is she was malnourished and apparently had escaped. The Nigerian military has really been ramping up its attacks on Boko Haram, and she was able to flee because the camp came under attack, and she also, I think, was hungry. She was also with a man and a baby. And that's providing a lot of intrigue because initially the man had said he was her husband and also a Boko Haram captive. But the military is saying that he is also a Boko Haram fighter.
So this is conceivably an escape and a defection on the part of this fighter. And it's also possible that based on the health of this young girl and the aerial bombardment reports that, I mean, the girls might be in some serious danger right now.
Well, I think the girls have been in some serious danger for the past 2 years. I mean, they're being held by fighters who might be raping them, who probably are not treating them particularly well. We know there's a big food crisis that Boko Haram has created and is now fallen victim to. The girl reportedly told people in her community that six others of the girls have died. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know.
Do people have faith in the Nigerian military to extract these girls and to keep the aerial bombardment from killing girls that, as you say, are in horrific conditions? But it would be so unfortunate if that would be the conclusion of this unfortunate situation.
I don't think anyone has any faith at all in the government or in the military. I mean, at least not the parents. I mean, these girls have been gone for 2 years, despite repeated pledges from the new president as well to find them. They still have hope, but faith, I think, has gone a long time ago. Now, military sources have said for some time that they believe these girls are being held as human shields in the forest. And so there's reason that Boko Haram would want to keep them alive because it keeps the military from bombing them. So that's one thing I think they have going in their favor.
Finally, is there the prospect of a reunion between this girl and a family member, parents? It's also the case that people who are abducted like this and are put through this compulsory sort of marriage ceremony by Boko Haram tend to be shunned by their families. So what's the situation?
Well, she has been delivered to her mother and did go to Chibok and met with community members, some of whom were crying and just really overjoyed to see her. So at least that hasn't happened just yet. But, you know, I think it's not going to be an easy road for her. There is so much mistrust of anyone who has spent any time with Boko Haram. I mean, this is a group of people who have been completely brutalized. You know, they've lost their homes, they've lost family members, and they're very, very suspicious of anyone who's been with Boko Haram, let alone someone who may have had a child with a Boko Haram fighter, which might be the case with this woman.
Dionne Cersei is the West Africa Bureau Chief of the New York Times, speaking from Dakar, Senegal. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This action is about a great deal more than bathrooms. This is about the dignity and the respect that we accord our fellow citizens and the laws that we as a people and as a country have enacted to protect them, indeed to protect all of us.
That's Attorney General Loretta Lynch this month setting up the principle she believes is at stake in fighting to strike down HB2, the so-called bathroom bill in North Carolina, which requires people to use the bathroom of the gender that was on their birth certificate, which would force many transgender people to disclose something about themselves in public that is very private. We decided to speak to two of them. For Austin J. Fonville and Erica Lakowitz, HB2 has had tangible consequences for their bodies and souls.
I had to make a decision one night. I thought I was doing the right thing. We were out and about, and I was looking a little androgynous, and you know, again, we always talk about passability and where people lie on that passability spectrum to make other people feel less uncomfortable. Unfortunately, that's just the way people see things in this binary view. So, you know, I made a decision to use the men's room because I felt, you know, not pretty enough to walk into the woman's room without maybe having somebody screaming or, you know, someone's boyfriend waiting for me outside to get punched, you know. I'll go into the stall, do my business, wash my hands, leave. Well, when I went in there, a couple people came in and, you know, I don't want to swear, but, you know, it was some pretty nasty words said to me and I locked myself in that stall. And my palms were sweating. I was anxious. When you sit there so confined and afraid and then more people start coming in and you don't know what to do. Your heart is going through your chest and you're being called these things. And it's like everybody looks at you based off of your appearance that, you know, this may be it. Can it be that in a bathroom, I may not walk out of here tonight? I don't want anyone else to go through that. And I know it comes from, you know, having these protections from the top down. It lends so much more than just where I go to the bathroom.
And I think, again, the mission is to understand what is the reality here for you. Austin, jump in here. I mean, I gather it's a little different in New Bern, North Carolina.
It's hard to explain, but I would just say that I never felt comfortable using the women's room even before testosterone. I would only like to go if I went with other friends. If I was by myself, I would hold it. I had urinary tract infection on top of the urinary tract infection because I was just scared to go into the women's room because I felt like I didn't belong. No one could see it, but in my mind, what I saw myself as did not fit in that room. And every time I would stop and see the door, and you see the one that says male or female, the female definitely didn't feel right. The male felt kind of right. I always felt like I should go into one right in the middle. But if I had to choose one, in this world, we have to choose. The men's bathroom was the one that I would choose. The first times I ever used a men's room, I didn't bind. I don't know if anybody knows what binding is, but it's to bind my breasts, right? So I bind those, and so that gives the chest a more male appearance. I wasn't even binding the first time I used the men's room. I just walked in there one day and used the bathroom, and the guy looked at me and he ran to the door to check to make sure he was in the right room. And when he realized he was in the right room, he said, shrugged his shoulders and finished his business. He didn't care what I looked like when I was in that men's room. And we're talking about 6 years ago. Transgender people have been here. Gender nonconforming people have been here. Governor McCrory created a problem that did not exist. And then he solved it by taking the rights away from one of the most marginalized people in our society.
When North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory signed HB 2 into law, the bill that regulates who can use public restrooms in the state, he claimed he was fighting a battle in a culture war.
This is an issue that the left started, not the right. And it's not just women's bathroom, it's boys' bathrooms. And in fact, the Obama administration now is putting requirements on state, on federal money given to states that they also have to have this gender identification requirement for our schools.
Talk of schools and young boys being at risk from people who call themselves transgender has created some very real consequences. Transgender people report that the spirit of the law violates things they have always associated with what they see as a progressive North Carolina. Our conversation continues now with Erica Lakowitz, a business applications manager in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Austin J. Fonville, a student in Grantsboro, North Carolina.
You know, we had some really forward-thinking city council members. Our mayor, she knows what it takes to grow a city. She's got this vision of creating a all-inclusive city with the infrastructure that Charlotte has, that when, you know, you have employees that are safe inside of your, you know, in your building, and then they go outside and they can be told, no, you can't use that restroom, or we don't sell to people like you, and potentially even get assaulted.
Austin?
North Carolina, the majority of the people are not like that. Now, there are some people, and that's anywhere and everywhere you go. But I was able to go to community college, one of the smallest community colleges in all of North Carolina. And all I had to do was tell people who I was, what I was to be called, what my pronouns were. I used the men's bathroom. There was never any problem. As soon as HB2 and all this stuff came out, it kind of put me in a different light, and I started to hear things. Now, my instructors and all of the staff in the school were fine. They actually, I think, were embarrassed because they put their head down and couldn't even look at me. I missed 2 weeks of school because I was actually too scared to go to school, afraid of what would happen when I went into school if I went to use the bathroom.
Well, it sounds like both of you, you know, we were motivated to talk with both of you because we figured that you would want to tell people something about yourselves that's different from this news madness that's happening, you know, something about your lives and how you experience your life. But you're also saying there's something about North Carolina that people need to understand here as well. And that's really interesting. Austin?
You know, there's some people when they don't understand, and that's when we don't understand anything. But when people get to meet me and they know me, like my doctor, I'm the first transgender person my doctor has ever had. When I went to the emergency room, I was the first transgender person that they had ever seen in that emergency room. You're talking about an emergency room in a big city.
And they were fine with it.
They were fine. What do you want me to call you? When I told them what I was supposed to be called, the nurses all ran around and told everybody because my name had not been changed yet. They put it on the chart big. The doctor came in. He said, how can I help you, sir? It was no problem. Nothing but respect. It is not all of North Carolina. It is this small group of people who have an agenda that, I mean, who knows exactly what it is. I mean, my thoughts sometimes are that right after the Marriage Equality Act, it's almost like they had to offer up something. And I think we were just what was offered up.
Hmm. We were their targets from the very beginning. We did a focus group here in Charlotte. And we had, before we passed the non-discrimination ordinance, various groups come together and show the pro and the con of what we were looking to do as a city. And I know when we look at the systemic battleground of LGMB legitimacy over the past 30 years, we've seen some advances and we've seen some takebacks, but the religious right, they came out hard. And, you know, we saw that at our events, you know, even people coming in from outside of Charlotte, you know, they They're quoting Leviticus, and I'm hearing all these, you know, Bible verses, but what I'm not hearing is dialogue. Do you know a transgender person? I've offered to talk to Pat McCrory. I've offered to talk to Dan Forrest. I've offered to talk to Berger. I mean, if you look at how many years we've been trying to get people aware of transgender issues in general, you know, people can understand it. But unless you are a transgender person, it's very, very, very hard to really grasp. It is almost impossible.
Well, this is amazing what you're saying here, because, I mean, you've been trying to get people to understand who you are and get some awareness, and they've, I mean, for all their intolerance, they've done it.
They did. And we have a group of people coming together who really do, across the state, want to see HB2 go away, but for the right reasons. You know, financially, we can make the state hurt, but everybody hurts. Nobody wants that. On a federal level, we can take funding away from education. I got a daughter in the school here. I don't want that, but I get it.
What do you think we'll say about this event 10 years from now, Austin?
My hope is that we'll be able to put this behind us and work on the things that we need to work on, the things that are more important in North Carolina. That's my hope and my belief that it will come to pass. It'll be fine. I'm just sorry we had to go through this. But one of the things I can say is I'm glad and I appreciate Pat McCrory. We don't know. I mean, maybe that was his agenda all along. Jokingly, I say that. Maybe that's what his idea was all along. Maybe he was trying to help us. And I mean, whether he was or not, he did. And I appreciate it. But I think in 5 years, we'll have this. In 5 years, it'll be sorted out. But I think we're going to look back and be a little ashamed of ourselves. And we should be.
Erica?
5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, one of the things that I would hope would change is when you see something that is different, you don't rush to a conclusion. You pull from as many internal resources as you can and you keep it internal. And when they see things that are of different, what they're not used to seeing, it's very often too easy to judge. So I'm hoping that as HB2 goes away, the next fight we fight, because equal rights, that's not going to ever end. But at the end of the day, for whoever is in the fight, you are personally affected when it becomes part of you. And the best solutions for anybody anywhere feeling oppression, whether they're going for a job interview, you stop and you look at the situation and you say to yourself, is this something that I would want to be leading as an example for my child? And that's what I have raised my daughter like, to think before she speaks, to be open, to be honest, and to pull from as many resources as she can before she makes her own decision.
Erica Lakowitz is a business applications manager in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Austin J. Fonville is a student in Grantsboro.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious Quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at curious.com/PRI.
I'm 26 years old, living in New York City at the end of the century. And this is what being Patrick Bateman means to me.
You know Patrick Bateman.
New card. What do you think?
Very nice.
Good coloring.
That's bone. And the lettering is something called Sicilian Braille.
It's very cool, Bateman, but that's nothing.
There's a race we're running to the breakdown coming. We say, uh-oh, uh-oh, uh-oh.
Something familiar here, yes? A flashback to the 80s? Come on, it's gotta ring a bell.
The city of the 1980s was so incredibly glitzed out and glamorous and status-obsessed, and everyone was worried about nightclubs all the time and getting into the right restaurants.
Look at history, open the books. There are statues with great looks. There are gods, there are kings. I'm pretty sure I'm the same thing.
The 80s is back in the form of Patrick Bateman, a ruthless, soulless, needy character created by author Bret Easton Ellis in his bizarre novel of death, sex, and money. It was no sedate podcast. It was a publishing fiasco that became a bestseller, then a movie with Christian Bale, and now a Broadway musical starring a completely ripped Benjamin Walker.
The streets are humming. I can feel what's coming. I say, uh-oh, uh-oh, uh-oh. You see me
gliding, but there's something hiding in the shadow, shadow, shadow.
David Johnson is founder of Act 4 Entertainment and producer of American Psycho, which he says forces the audience to wonder if the show is about then or now.
There's absolutely a potential tension because you could see this going one of two ways. It could either be a send-up to the 80s and kind of a fun 80s romp, or it could be really what the novel's about, what it's about now. It's about the 80s, but it's more true now than it was in the 80s, which is about the economic divide in this country, about a sense of purposelessness. No, I think it's true in kind of fun, silly ways, like the food craze and, you know, people eating very specialized foods and, you know, that and how, and it's all about, you know, very exotic and food. And I think even Brett has said that's very funny because when he wrote it, he thought that would be absolutely a passing fad.
Yeah.
No, and, it's gotten, and it's not. It's more so. More. In fact, one of the problems that they were having when they say these things that were outrageous when they were written, they don't sound that outrageous.
But the line sun-dried tomato reduction gets a laugh.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, yeah.
It's very nice. Yeah, like that. Yeah. The idea that Donald Trump is a joke in the book, he's a character sort of haunting the book in just humor, but now he's a candidate for president, suggests that you're onto some sort of apocalyptic kind of trajectory.
Probably
here.
Strong, but it's it's obviously, I mean, an interesting thing. I mean, I think in the, you know, somebody pointed out that Donald Trump of the novel is different than the Donald Trump now because Donald Trump then was, you know, was a real estate mogul. He had a certain lifestyle and obviously spendability and, you know, those kind of things that that if you wanted a certain thing in that time period, you might look to.
Mm-hmm.
Donald Trump now is obviously a political, serious figure in a certain way. He's definitely a political figure.
Right.
And it is a different position in the world. And that's you could say that's a change in Donald Trump, or you can say it's a change in the world.
I also found that the staging of this show is really a whole other piece of theater that I hadn't seen before. It's really amazing.
And Ez and Vin are incredibly talented. You know, Ez, I don't know if you looked at her background at all, but she does some opera. She also does very big projects. She does a lot of the big you know, music stars now, Beyonce and U2, I don't want to start naming because there's so many, but she does all that. She also did like the closing ceremony for the London Olympics. She's doing opening for Rio. So, I mean, she does big projects. You need to know throughout that it's the 80s because, you know, that is what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
It's written about that time period. It is a very specific time period. So there's like the Sony Walkman.
Right.
But I don't want, we didn't want, as a team, we didn't want people to feel that it's about the 80s. It's about now. So I think part of the reason you can feel that way is when you see the staging, it could absolutely be someone's apartment now. It's not dated other than sort of things that it's specifically marked for the date, like when he talks about his television having picture-in-picture capability. Mm-hmm. There are things that are specifically 80s. But in general, the way you feel about what you're seeing is that it's absolutely now. You forget that it's in the 80s. You think it's now, I think.
Is it hard to make a musical out of this show? The New York Times review said there's no original music from the show that is memorable or as memorable as the 80s hits that go along with it. What's your response to that?
Well, I think every review is very personal. You know, part of, I think, why people become reviewers is they love theater and they love and I think people who become Broadway reviewers love Broadway. It doesn't seem like this would be Broadway. This seems, one of my friends said, I'm surprised you didn't do it as an opera. You know, there's a seriousness. There's a, you know, people were very thoughtful about it. We have a friend who saw this. Who, you know, you can always tell if a friend likes it or not. I will come eventually to your question, but we have a friend who saw this. Who was a economist. He wrote a very complicated email about how much he liked it. The next day, he wrote like three paragraphs saying what he thinks it meant. And so, I mean, he's thinking about it all day. People do that. You can tell people don't like it because they write something like, thank you so much for a great evening. You know, it's that sort
right,
of
right, 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 right.
And I feel like you either really like this or you really don't.
Well, this and show think, stays with you. This show and, stays with you.
But you either really like it or you're almost offended that we did it. And I think that's a very personal thing. And I think it's about you.
You know, I love the show. I loved it because it was such a huge reach. I just thought, man, you guys are really playing in the stratosphere. And I like that. And I looked at this and I thought, you know, you said opera and it occurs to me,
one of the things that's unique about this is that the music is a really powerful bed for the emotions that are going on, but the 80s hits kind of stand out as the arias.
Yeah.
Well, great experience, a great show. And what's your aspiration from here on?
Oh, well, you know, we're releasing a documentary on environmental justice that's opening this month at the LA Film Festival. So we're very excited about that. We're doing another documentary on drones. We're doing a comedy on political campaign finance.
Is there a common theme in the work that you do?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything that we do, we try and do for a social and political purpose. And the themes that are big for us are economic justice and human rights. So we have a lot. We're trying to do a lot of different kinds of projects that are in the areas that we think we really do believe that if you make people feel and think differently about things, then you can move them to act differently, both in a broad way and with themselves. So that's what we're trying to do.
Well, David Johnson, who would have thought an idealist made it through the 80s? Love that.
Thanks so much. Very nice.
Thank
you.
Thank you. David Johnson, founder of Act 4 Entertainment, most recently produced the live stage musical version of American Psycho. To see photos from the stage production of American Psycho, head over to thetakeaway.org. And here's something to take with you today from the 1980s We Told You So department.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Ronald Reagan said this in West Berlin in June of 1987. What, the Berlin Wall come down? Reagan believed it would, and it did, 2 years later. In October of 1987, a woman named Louise Dexter of Nebraska said this about an up-and-coming businessman in New York. He's always seeking out profitable business opportunities and willing to take chances. How about Donald Trump for president? I'm not running for president, Trump told Newsweek's reporter in 87, but if I did, I'd win. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Huckenberry. This is The Takeaway. You said,
this much you support for The Takeaway comes from Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers, and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.